Good morning, this is AM. I'm Kim Landers. There's a 50-50 chance taxpayers could be left to foot a clean-up bill for Victoria's open-cut brown coal mines, a bill that could run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. That's the evidence from the state's mining regulator to the Hazelwood Mine Fire Inquiry. The inquiry has been looking into the rehabilitation of brown coal mines in Victoria's east. It's also questioned why successive Victorian governments have allowed the companies behind some of Australia's dirtiest power stations to shirk their clean-up obligations. Robert French reports from Sale.
It was a startling admission. Victoria's mining regulator believes there's a 50% chance the mining companies Energy Australia, AGL and GDF Suez could become insolvent, leaving a big clean-up bill for taxpayers.
That's your agreement, that's a correct rating of that risk?
Yes.
Is that right?
The three companies' mines at Yallourn, Loyang and Hazelwood play a vital role in powering the nation. But the companies are under pressure with the recent slumps in coal and electricity prices, making it more likely they'll consider closing the mines earlier than expected. Ross McGowan is the Executive Director of Victoria's Mining Authority, Earth Resources Regulation.
Any company at any time, depending on their exposure on whatever market they're trading in, there's always a financial risk to not being able to pay their debts when they fall due, or happens all the time.
Victorian regulations require mining operators to pay a bond equal to the estimated cost of rehabilitation, but that hasn't happened in the Latrobe Valley. Each of the mines was set a bond of $15 million 20 years ago, and in 2004, the government cut Yallourn's payment by $3.5 million. An independent report from technical services company ACOM puts the clean-up cost for the most expensive of the mines, Hazelwood, at up to 20 times what's been set aside. Economist Michael Kramer from Access Environmental told the inquiry, the greater the gap between the rehabilitation bond and the liability, the greater the risk taken on by the state.
I think in that case there's a degree of moral hazard that exists, because it may be in the proponent's interest to walk away from the site from a purely financial perspective, forgetting about other issues such as reputational risk.
So why have state governments made no attempt to increase the bonds? Council assisting Peter Rosen suggested it was out of fear the mining companies might exit early.
Has that been part of the department's thinking as to the inaction on the bond levels? Mr McGowan, can you help?
Certainly not part of my thinking.
The inquiry's board will hear closing submissions today and deliver its final report in January.
Robert French reporting. The controversial ride-sharing company Uber is a digital disruptor both loved and hated around the world. Loved by passengers who want cheaper fares and hated by taxi owners and drivers who've seen the value of their licences dwindle. But the rise of Uber in Australia seems unstoppable. New South Wales has followed the ACT in legalising the Uber X service, to the delight of these Sydney-siders.
Probably best that it's actually gone through like a proper process now. So I guess it's better, more regulations, probably safer as well.
It's just really accessible and a really cheap alternative to other modes of transportation.
It's much better than taxis. They're giving the consumer what they want instead of the consumer being forced to what taxis are giving them.
I've had Uber drivers come in bow ties. They come open the door for you, give you a glass or a bottle of water as well as some mints. And because they know that if they don't get rated well, then they can't drive.
But will consumers actually be better off? New South Wales taxi owners will be compensated $20,000 per licence, but all passengers will have to pay a $1 levy for each trip over the next 5 years. Uber's general manager in Australia, David Rorsheim, was cautious about the deal when he spoke with our business editor, Peter Ryan.
We're excited that UberX has been confirmed as having a place in New South Wales. All the details we're still waiting to see. The idea of a levy, though, does sound a bit surprising. People are looking for affordable way to get from A to B, and we do find it a bit strange the government would willingly raise those fares.
Is that $1 levy per trip an unintended consequence, given that Uber is meant to be in the business of getting a better deal for taxi-weary passengers and not attracting another state government tax?
Indeed. I find it strange that the government would get in the middle of that and willingly raise fares, which makes this transportation less attractive.
But doing that type of deal on a levy or a tax that will ultimately be passed on to consumers, is that a price that Uber has to pay to operate in Australia?
We're waiting to see all the details, but we'll comply with all the relevant regulations.
Current owners of taxi licences will be compensated $20,000 a licence for up to two plates, but that's just a fraction of the hundreds of thousands of dollars the licences were worth before Uber came on the scene.
That's something that deserves, I think, more careful examination. These taxi plates have been, in some cases, granted free of charge, and some people have held them for many, many decades and have enjoyed a very, very healthy return. So I think they've had a very, very good run.
So do you think that compensation is too much or not enough?
I think it's too early to say. We don't have the facts in front of us, but I think it deserves, you know, careful examination.
You could also argue that owners of horses and buggies weren't compensated when cars came along, or the makers of typewriters when computers were introduced. But when it comes to taxis, this is real people who are seeing their livelihoods disappear.
Yeah, you know, this isn't the last industry that's going to face some digital disruption, and you know, their response to this new innovation and this very popular service that 500,000 Sydney-siders are using, their response to this will shape expectations for future disruption, future industries that undergo change.
But do you have any compassion for the supposed victims here, intended or otherwise, of this digital disruption?
I think the way that the financial situation of some owners has been portrayed isn't the full story. A bunch of people got these plates free of charge.
Now, UberX is legal now in the ACT and New South Wales, but illegal elsewhere. It's especially emotional in places like Victoria and Queensland. How are you going to win those states over?
There's a review underway in almost every state across Australia, and you know, we've got no reason to believe they'll reach a different conclusion. New South Wales deserves credit today for finishing their review first and showing some leadership.
How much time and money are you spending in the lobbying to get this across the line?
Our main lobbyists are our users, 500,000 in New South Wales, more than 1 million across Australia. They take rides, and when we ask them to, you know, participate in these government reviews and say, what do you think? You know, they're overwhelmingly supportive, and most importantly, the drivers themselves.
Uber's general manager in Australia, David Rorschheim, with our business editor, Peter Ryan. Domestic violence services are calling for an urgent injection of funding to help meet the increased demand over the Christmas break. Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia, which runs the 1800 Respect Counselling line, is bracing for a busy festive season. It says domestic violence rates tend to rise over Christmas when there's increased alcohol abuse and financial stresses. Lindy Kerin reports, and a warning, this story contains some disturbing details.
This time of year is always difficult for Lani Brennan. She was nearly killed by her former partner on Christmas night.
I knew deep down, I got to have that feeling I was going to die that night. We started the bonfire at the front of the house, and when he started the bonfire, he brought out some drink. And when he come back out, the next time he come back out with a hammer, and he started to beat me with the hammer.
He dragged her into the house where the attack continued for many hours.
He dragged me in and I was beaten physically and sexually assaulted the whole night continuously. If you can picture a house, every piece of furniture, every tool that's inside a house I was beaten with.
The CEO of Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia, Karen Willis, says the Christmas period will see an increase in domestic violence.
We will certainly have non-stop calls around domestic violence that's occurred during that period of time. And police from 3 o'clock on Christmas Day in the afternoon, their calls just go manic as well. We will have 200 shifts, 8 hours each, on every week over this period. And we know that we're not going to get anywhere near answering every single call to the service.
In September, the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull announced a $100 million package to tackle family violence. But Karen Willis says the money hasn't started rolling in to the frontline service.
At the time of the announcement, I mean, that was the first policy announcement and was the largest chunk of money. We were wildly excited. And in fact, we received an 8% increase in calls that day as a result of that announcement. Some of that money, I understand, has started to roll. There was some money allocated to this service. We haven't received that yet. I'm not sure when that's going to happen. It takes a little bit of time from when money is announced to when it gets to, because it needs to be rolled out, there needs to be contracts and agreements, and then of course you need to employ staff, you need to train them up, you need to get them on the job. So an announcement last September may mean an increase in services round about March of next year.
Lani Brennan now works to raise awareness about family violence. She has a new partner and six daughters, and she says she's reclaimed Christmas as a special time with her family.
My children are my life. I try not to look at Christmas as a negative no more for me. I see it as, well, I fled domestic violence around Christmas time. It was the hardest time of my life I survived, and I try and put a positive spin on it every Christmas.
Domestic violence survivor Lani Brennan speaking to Lindy Kerin. This is AM Around Australia, where it's 20 minutes past 7. He was dubbed the most hated man in America after his company jacked up the price of a drug used by HIV and cancer patients by 5,000%. Today, the 32-year-old former hedge fund manager, Martin Shkreli, is in custody, charged with securities fraud for running his companies like a Ponzi scheme. And as North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports, he could face up to 20 years in jail.
Martin Shkreli likes to show off, putting live feeds of himself on the internet, declaring himself the world's most eligible bachelor, and in May he bought the only copy of an album released by the group Wu-Tang Clan for $2 million. Cash rules everything around me. Green, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Later, the group was so horrified by his business practices, they gave a large chunk of the money to charity. That business practice was buying a cheap $13 medicine and charging patients $750. Martin Shkreli tried to explain to CBS at the time that he wasn't being greedy.
The drug was unprofitable at the former price, so any company selling it would be losing money. And at this price, it's a reasonable profit, not excessive at all.
In fact, he called it altruistic, saying he wanted to put that money back into new drug research. Today, after he was arrested, investigators were asked if that price hike was a way to quickly pay off his bad debts. US Attorney Robert Capers says it wasn't part of this investigation, but he did outline in detail how Shkreli operated a Ponzi scheme to take money from a new company to pay back investors from other hedge funds he'd drained over a period of 5 years.
He perpetrated the fraud in a number of ways, by backdating documents to create an investment that didn't exist. They then entered into settlement agreements with some of the defrauded invested hedge fund investors and paid them using Retrophin's assets that they hid from the board of directors and from outside auditors.
The director of enforcement for the Securities and Exchange Commission, Andrew Ceresni.
In his first year operating his hedge fund, MSMB Capital, from November 2009 to November 2010, Shkreli spent, misappropriated, or lost through poor trading decisions all but $331 of the $660,000 or so of investor funds raised.
Martin Shkreli faces up to 20 years in jail if convicted. Investigators are not yet saying if the Wu-Tang Clan album was among any assets seized. This is Michael Vincent for AM.
A senior Chinese anti-corruption chief says he wants to make sure graft suspects who flee to Australia don't abuse the legal system to avoid facing justice. Australia is one of the top countries for Chinese corruption suspects to hide out in. But cooperation with Australian authorities has been hampered by concerns about transparency and the death penalty in China's legal system. China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
It's not often that a senior official from the Chinese Communist Party's secretive Central Discipline Commission holds a media conference. But the Q&A session with Liu Jianchao, who directs the commission's overseas relations, was part of a newfound transparency push. In China's three-year-long corruption crackdown, 800 suspects have so far been brought back from overseas. But Mr. Liu says there are plenty more.
In April this year, Interpol issued a red notice for China's most wanted 100 corruption suspects. From that list, 18 have been brought back to China or surrendered themselves to police.
Up to 10 on that list are believed to either be in or linked to Australia. But with no formal extradition treaty, Chinese agents have reportedly tried to bypass Australian authorities on several occasions to convince suspects to return to China voluntarily.
In Australia, using persuasion to get suspects to return seems to be the most effective method. But it's not as though Australia and China haven't carried out cooperation in this regard. We've created some effective mechanisms and achieved some results. China will respect the laws and legal procedures of the host countries, but at the same time will try to make sure the fugitives will not be able to enjoy opportunities to abuse the laws of the relevant country.
China's international fugitive hunt has become a key part of President Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive. The return of major graft suspects from overseas is regularly highlighted in the state-run media. But countries like Australia, the US and Canada pose a problem for China. They don't have extradition treaties to easily facilitate the return of suspects. And London-based China watcher Professor Kerry Brown says there are good reasons to be hesitant.
I mean, the concern about the death penalty is pretty real because, I mean, there have been people given the death sentence during this latest campaign, basically. The treatment of suspects in China is not great. Now, I mean, some governments, like the Canadian government, returned a fugitive to China a few years ago who had been involved in a very big smuggling scandal in the 1990s because they got assurances that the Chinese would not use torture or would not use the death sentence. You know, this is all case by case. It's pretty time consuming. That one took over a decade to sort out.
The Chinese government is keen to assure Western nations that fugitives who are returned face a fair trial. But even though that might be a tough sell, there's plenty of time for convincing. 3 years in, with 30,000 officials already punished and thousands more investigated, Liu Jianchao says the campaign won't wind down anytime soon.
Fighting corruption will be a long-term course which cannot be completed in 2 or 3 years or 2 or 3 decades.
This is Bill Birtles in Beijing reporting for AM.
As celebrations subside following the Paris Climate Accord, the world's third biggest emitter, India, is warning its coal consumption will still double in coming years. India is committed to developing renewable energy, but says its reliance on coal won't be changing. South Asia correspondent James Bennett reports.
In Article 2 of the deal struck several days ago lies a clause which, like so many others in the document, uses 17 words to say what could be achieved in 5 or 6. It directs that the parties, i.e. countries of the world, quote, make finance flows consistent with a pathway towards such low greenhouse gas emissions and climate-resilient development. Environmental groups have trumpeted that mouthful as significant, essentially translating into stop investing in coal. Irrespective of a secondary debate amongst Indians about whether the clause is aimed at them, the subcontinental view is it won't work. Among Indian observers in Paris was the deputy of Delhi's Centre for Science and the Environment, Chandrabhushan.
So I think the whole focus only on coal by environmental group is going to backfire. So let me say that first of all. Secondly, as far as financing coal is concerned, I don't think it is going to impact India much, simply because India's coal financing is done much more from domestic resources.
The Brookings Institute's Indian climate and sustainable energy expert Rahul Tongia agrees.
The reaction to that domestically in India was, that's okay. At this point, domestic funding and cash flows are sufficient to manage the projected growth, at least in the foreseeable future. So I don't think that financing will diminish the coal sector.
India is in the process of building an impressive 170 gigawatts of wind and solar power, aiming for 40% non-fossil generation in 15 years. And coal's share of India's electricity generation will fall. But 300 million people still don't have any electricity to begin with. To meet their needs and power an economy still growing at close to 8% a year, state-owned coal miner Coal India has this week confirmed that it remains on track to double its output over the next decade. India has been hectored internationally over the plans, but economist Rathan Roy, director of India's National Institute of Public Finance and Policy, argues people should instead consider the several hundred million still living in the dark.
This has become a theological issue for the environmental lobby, who do not seem to understand that the alternative is horrendous. I don't think any country or any Australian would want any Indian child to not have access to a light bulb.
After the weekend deal was struck, India's Energy Minister Piyush Goyal posted on Twitter that while his country was, quote, contributing to the growth of renewable energy, it would simultaneously make sure our development process does not get hampered. And Chandrabhushan from Delhi's Centre for Science and the Environment argues that the text itself means India won't be alone.
Paris gives a 10 years of moratorium to countries, frankly, not to do anything. And therefore, till 2025, I do not expect countries to change their climate policy significantly.
This is James Bennett in New Delhi, reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. In finance, Wall Street is more than 0.5% lower after a steep fall in the price of crude oil hurt energy companies. The Australian dollar is down sharply at 71.13 US cents. I'm Kim Landers. It's 7:30.